Go ahead, Phil.
Well, this is a special class. I'm Phil Schultz, and I have the honor of introducing both Cecile Barlier and Mark Peterson, and Cecile's new book, Gypsy's Book of Revelation, which is quite a remarkable book of short stories. I have a feeling that a number of you have already read it and come to that understanding yourselves. Just a few words about her, and then I'm going to give a general sense of an introductory general sense of how I see the work. And then Mark, who's worked with her, I mean, who's her teacher and who started the San Francisco, obviously a beloved teacher and gifted teacher, will introduce her further and give you more background. Just a few biographical notes. Cecile was born in France and received her master's degree from the Sorbonne, and has lived here in the States for over 2 years, raising two daughters and working alongside her husband, Pierre, as an entrepreneur. She lives in Lafayette, which she's explained is just behind Berkeley. She's living there because it's a French name. Three of her short stories were nominated for the Pushcart Prize. One story, Forgetting, was featured in our Epiphanies, the Writer Studio at 30 Anthology. And Cecile won the 2019 Grace Paley Prize for Short Story, which is a very prestigious prize for short stories. Grace Paley would be proud, believe me. I knew her, and she would have been delighted with this. She liked to argue, and she would find a great deal in there to argue about. Her other work has been featured in a variety of literary magazines, and you can all see that in the book. You can all get that in the book. I'd like to begin. The play of imagination here is extraordinary. It's the originality is quite extraordinary. And, when you read a Hemingway story for the first time, it's different from anyone else's. When you Elizabeth Bishop poem, it's different. It goes on. Like this, this strikes me as being unlike anything that I know, and I, am familiar with Shepherd and Machado, but there's something here that creates a world unto itself. If I may, I think this is done usually by a writer daring to challenge material, daring to go after material that is frightening, that others don't. They attempt, but they stop short. The rewards are, of course, imagination. In fact, you need to harness and use your imagination as a way, as a distancing technique, and of course, a persona, which Mark is going to address the formation of this persona. We have a new exercise here at the Writer's Studio, journal writing with using a persona. And the whole purpose of this started with the extraordinary results that Kafka brought, and then Edouard Louis, and then Hanke, and now Camus. And the thing they all allowed writers to go after material that would seem new. The journal exercise grew out of my trying to find an exercise that somehow addressed what all of these writers, all of these personas allowed writers to do. Now, Cecile has come to this all on her own. I mean, this is long before our journal exercise, and which in itself is extraordinary. My point here is that the very thing that this exercise encourages, allows the writer to do, is what she's doing. By going after material that is scary. Like, in other words, it's a kind of search. We want to know ourselves from a new perspective. We want to go after a part of ourselves that no small part of ourselves is afraid to do. Open that last door, or open a series of doors. Whether it's incest, or it's the terror of losing a child on a highway, imagining being a gypsy woman, a corpse who's about to be cremated. I mean, who does this? If you hadn't read that story and you came up with that as an exercise, imagine all the fear that you would be confronted with. In fact, there's no small amount of confrontation in going after material that is this challenging. So I think certainly we want to address how Cecile found a persona and the courage to go after material on this level. Now, if I may, I would just like one short paragraph. And Cecile, would you read? It's on page 109. Where that new section starts, it was a mild fall day, and it goes to just the first three lines of the next page. This section shows what I'm talking about, this use of persona. Okay, would you read that?
Sure. It was a mild fall day. The light and warmth of it had settled in the air with a thin veil of lightheartedness. A young moon was there with a barely visible halo crescent, as if self-conscious of its own glow. Obscurity was moving in on us as we walked through town to the campus where the party would take place. Mia didn't speak. She was wearing a polka dot black and white dress with a black cardigan and flats. The fading light seemed to be brushing her face from underneath her. Her skin and hair intensified, as if captured through a camera obscura. I felt complete. I felt, in the walking by her side, that life was giving me the ultimate accomplishment. Why? Because in walking next to her through the descending evening, we belonged to each other in our parallel path. And what else could I do to top that? From the second we stopped walking till the day I died, I'd live knowing that this moment would belong to a sepia-colored place in my soul. I knew it with the same vividness as the mystery of faith revealed. And a realization brought me a pleasure only found in the darkness of repression, a pain as sacred as this restraint preventing it from being manifested.
Well, it seems to me that the goal here, conscious or not, is ecstasy. that this persona wants to not only experience it, re-experience it, but share that intense degree of pleasure with the reader. It's quite a goal. And we get that throughout. And of course, in order to do that, you need a high degree of imagination and willfulness, or as Camus would say, free will, and guiltlessness. So let me stop there. And Mark, you take over.
Yeah, thanks, Phil. I'm going to say a few things before I come back to your point and your interest. One, I want to thank Cecile.
Oh,
I mean, as much as I've been, a decent teacher, I would say I've learned from Cecile and from all of the people that have been in the class that have, progressed with us over the past 10, 12, 13 years. Cecile, as you said, I started the Writer Studio in San Francisco in 2007, and Cecile joined in early 2008, and has really steadily been in it the entire time, participating. And I'm gonna sidetrack a little bit. I heard a quote or heard something. I can't remember where I got this, but I thought it was really interesting and applied so much to Cecile. People tend to underestimate what they can do in 1 year, or overestimate what they can do in 1 year, but underestimate what they can do in 10 years. And I think, this book is about 10 years of work. Cecile has, and it's probably about half of her total output, as far as I can tell, maybe even less than that, I don't know. There's a lot of additional work that was published and a lot of work she's continuing on that's forthcoming. It's really amazing how much she has accomplished at the rate of 2 pages a week, which is really a reference to how well she has, taken the Writer Studio method and really progressed it and used it and leveraged it and made it how she works to come, to be that brave and be everything you just said about with her personas. Because I might be wrong, but I don't think Cecile, as I recall, Cecile had not written at all previous to joining the Writer Studio, or at least very minimally. And I recall her being very shy when she started with the program and uncertain. But like I said, everything she's done, every piece in here started as a Writer Studio exercise. And maybe more than anyone, she's closely followed the methods and rules that we tend to try and apply in our workshops. That said, I think one of the things I love about her approach is that she does always find, I'll say, extra tricks to embody the persona, to take an exercise and make it, add a twist or expand it some way. Fundamentally take it, expand the technique, and make it her own. And those are the types of questions we want to talk about as we progress. How did she do the paragraph she just read? How did she get, what were the extra things that she did to take the technique and really make it her own? I can't recall, I was thinking through the stories, I can't recall in a single one of these stories what exercise originally generated it. That's how completely she takes the technique and makes it her own and really creates her own persona narrator for each piece. So I really, the amount of work and dedication that Cecile brings to this is amazing, right? So one, I asked her that. I asked, if we could go back in time, what advice she would give herself, give to herself 12 years ago or 13 years ago now. So her answer, I'm just going to read it because I thought it was so good that it's well worth reading. Her answer was, establish your discipline. Set time aside to work consistently. Fiercely protect that time against inevitable invasions. If you follow these three, the rest gets easier. Experiment. Get curious. Stay curious. Ask a lot of questions. Keep finding more questions. Let the questions stay unanswered. Find your creative triggers. Be patient. Stay patient. Be slow. Stay slow. Accept the waste. Cut the waste. Mind the waste. Let the story lead. Get in the back seat. It's 50-50. You getting the story and story getting to you. So with that, I'm gonna turn it back to Cecile. I think Cecile, these are the things we're curious about, right? We want to hear more as we talk about your stories. How do you get that extra twist, as I refer to it? How do you find the opportunity to be brave and really create these persona narrators? And let's talk about that.
Right? Yeah.
So I don't know, Phil, if you'd like to talk more about the paragraph we just read, or if we want to jump in.
No.
Gypsy or Cecile, you want to say a few words? I'm happy. I think all of that's good.
Yeah, so before we start with the stories themselves, I really want to, first of all, it's so strange to be on the other side. I've seen so many of these, and now seeing all of you, that I've known, that you don't know me, but I know you because I've watched so many classes over the years. So it's really weird. I want to thank you because I obviously, and sometimes saying thank you feels a little trivial. It feels forced and sincere. I hope that this one will ring true because it's really true. When I started, as Mark said, I hadn't written anything ever. What I used to do maybe as a kid, I wrote a little poetry here or there, and then I wrote speeches like my wedding speech, stuff like that, nothing really serious. I hit back in 08, I had just moved to California, and I hit a little bit of a rough spot in life, and I was looking for something to do that would be mine, that would be just mine. And so I thought about writing because I had always thought about it, but never done anything like that. And I Googled, workshops, writing workshops, and I called Mark. And I said, Mark, I'm French. I haven't written anything in my entire life, but could I please attend if only as an observer? And, in his very easygoing American way, he said, yeah, of course, come on over. And so I came and I started writing 2 pages at a time, exercise after exercise. And I set time aside to do that. It's Friday afternoon for me. Everybody who knows me knows where to find me on Friday afternoon. I'm here at the stable where I'm speaking from, and I'm writing, and it's Friday afternoon. And ever since 08, I've been doing this only one time a week, Friday afternoon, I write. And this is incredible. I think the technique that has been developed with the workshop is amazing. It's, we're all, I think, on some level wary of, but what if we're doing that, we're going to be doing plagiarism. We're just going to repeat what somebody else has already done. And inevitably, the closer we follow the reference, even on a sentence by sentence level, the more original the work becomes. It's amazing. I don't even know why that works in this way, but it does. You know, a friend from the group told me recently, or told us recently, that she was scared that not only was she following the writer's technique so closely, but she felt that she was also borrowing the material, and that felt so wrong to her. And her work was so original and so vastly different from the original piece. It was a Davis in this case, Lydia Davis. But it's so interesting on that level. So I want to put that in there, because I have complete, this is how I work now. I'm so formatted by the workshop. This is the only way I can work. I need a reference, I need a voice, and then I can start. If I don't have that, I'm completely lost. I can't do anything. The other thing I will say, and so I think there's something that, you know, our pieces, they borrow from those references. It's like the references are the parents. You know, we're never going to say a child is plagiarism to a parent. No, it comes with, it's the heritage. You know, it comes with a sound, certain traits you recognize, but it's not the same thing, God forbid, thank God, you know? So I think there's, to me, that's the closest analogy. It's the heritage, maybe the diving board from which you can jump off into something that's unknown. So the other thing I want to say is, to me, beyond the method, also the format of the classes, I find absolutely amazing. The fact that you come to class with your two-pager, that you pick somebody to read who's not you, listening to your own work is your first shock, right? Because by then you already learned something. And then the fact that you have to sit silent through the critique, that you're not allowed to say anything, that you just have to soak it in. And sometimes it's hard, but you still sit through it. And always out of this comes something amazing. By the time I leave class, I know whether what I produce is crap, whether it has any leg, whether there's something promising here. And sometimes I'm very surprised by the effect of things I've done. I had no idea. And I still to this day, when my turn comes, my heart beats. You know, I'm scared. And it's been like more than 10 years. And I'm always thinking, will I be next? What's gonna happen? So the other thing that it does is, like, you know, you're not only being critiqued, and it's so immensely helpful for the work, but also you're giving critique. And in doing so, you learn so much, not only on a writing level, but on a human level. You learn how to deliver stuff that could be really hurtful in a way that is not, in a way that will hopefully produce change. You learn to be an honest, because you want to be honest. If the work doesn't cut it because of whatever reason, you want to explain, you want to give, you know, what your heartfelt critique and your heartfelt comment about the piece to make it grow. And I think that makes really, that's so unique. I mean, I don't know of any other circumstance in which you're both the critiqued and the critique, and you have to really care. And you have to be sincere, and you have to accept, and you have to give. And so I think that's, I want to also say thank you for that, because I think out of that, you know, you become, I hope, a better person, somebody who's at once honest and very ruthlessly so, but also gentle. And so I think that's important. So yeah, I want to say thank you for all those Fridays, all those Mondays and Tuesdays and all of you that don't know me, but that I think I know on some level. So
thank you. I was just gonna say, let's jump into, can we read like picture number five from Gypsy?
Can I just first say that the generosity of the stories is what you just displayed. It's, you know, so it was very moving to me. Thank you.
You know, Phil, I was going to say this earlier, where I meant to say that in many ways, I mean, Cecile has done all the work herself, and I absolutely, the amount of dedication is unbelievable. But I really think this craft class to me is a celebration of both Cecile and her work and of the writer studio.
Yeah, I would agree. Shall I read?
Yes, let's read.
So it's page 14 of the first story, Gypsy's Book of Revelation. Picture number five. People in the city get to see the smoke. It rises to the north like the vertical contrails of an airplane. It is not me yet. I am not in it. It comes from the ever-light hearth, the furnace temperature now gradually ascending to a boiling climax. Despite the stiffness, my body is full of water, and it will take a lot of heat to vaporize it all. In a few minutes, I will shoot upward. And once again, I realize that it is a one-way trip I've taken. I don't mind this, actually. I am quite pleased with the rocket launch departing. We are a traveling people, and I am no exception. The crematorium is not far from our encampment. The gajo tells my children they will have to move once this is done. I don't want them under the sky I will occupy. I need to rest, and they need to live. A few miles away, a wanderer asks his friend, who in their right mind has lit a fire in the midst of August? Stranger, I am not in my right mind and no longer in the right body. If anything, I have earned the right to insanity, and it took me a lifetime.
Go ahead, Phil. No, go ahead.
I'm dying to ask, why a gypsy? How did you come up with that? I mean, and I have to say, everyone I know has heard me on the beach this morning describe how this white guy who was made to give the introduction and the elegy has to hold the hand of the corpse. Like, where do you come up with this?
So it's really interesting because the story didn't have a gypsy in it initially. So the story comes from my grandfather on my dad's side. My grandfather did something really strange. He wrote his own posthumous speech that was read to us in church. I was 15 at the time. Now, I don't know whether I invented that, because when I ask my parents now, or my mom, they don't remember, but I vividly remember that he wrote a speech that was read to us in church, and I even remember what was said. So it was something that stuck with me, and I wanted to do the same. I wanted to write a posthumous speech to a family. And I hit a wall for a very long time, because I was trying to write the speech, which was so stupid, because it felt so forced. I didn't have anything to say to my family after I passed, even if I put myself in their shoes. It felt so professorial, boring. And so I started to think, you know, I really want this to be fun. And what culture has it in themselves where funerals are actually fun? And the only thing that I could come up with is movies from Costa Rica that I had watched as an adolescent, where there are those funerals where the gypsies are crazy, kids are running all over the place, they're lifting the coins from the corpse, you know, the coins that are on the eyes. And I thought, this is perfect. This is what I need. I need a gypsy. And then I looked up, usually a lot of times I need visuals. And so in order to get me started, I need to empty myself and really come into, slide into my narrator or my character, whether it's actually first or third person, doesn't matter. I need somebody. And so I looked up at pictures, and the picture that's the book cover now came up on my screen. And I had that woman looking at me and taunting me and telling me, hey, Anna, you're not going to be able to tell my story ever. And I was under her watch. It was really difficult. And at some point, it started. I started having fun. And then I think Mark, you pushed me, because initially she wasn't dead attending her own cremation. She was imagining it. And Mark, you pushed me and you said, why do that? Why wouldn't she be just dead and just get started? And then that was perfect. It was so much more fun. And then I figured I didn't have to write the damn speech. I just could write anything around it. And that was a much better strategy and certainly much more fun. Yeah. So that's how it came about.
Another one of the things that, how did the framing of each section being a picture come up? How did that happen?
I think that was at the very end. I was, so I had those snippets, those mini scenes, and I was thinking, so how do I make them fit together? And then I read an article in the New Yorker about the Book of Revelation. And I was like, yeah, this is perfect. I need one picture after the next. This is how it's going to come about. This is her visions, like visions of the apocalypse, you know, one after the other. And I was, but that was like the finishing touch. This didn't really help me. I think it just came at the end to structure it.
I want to drill in on that question, on your point about the cover, the picture itself a little bit too, which is, you know, the language is so poetic and throughout, right? How, and you talked about the having that picture to help get to the persona, which comes first for you? Is it, do you need that picture? When do you get to use this great language that is present in all the stories? I realize, it's funny looking back on it. It's, to me, it's present when we're working on it, but it's not as present as when I read it now. And I almost wonder, how do you think of that? How do you get to the persona? Does a persona become the language, or is it present both? I know I'm not asking that question very well, but it's how do you get there, right? To the voice, ultimately. How do you get to the voice?
Well, I think I start with the voice. So I have, mm-hmm. Usually I have that reference piece, which triggers me. And then I have the image of the narrator, maybe, like in this case. And then they speak. And so language comes about from the narrator. And my job is to let the narrator go as much as I can. And I think I was saying, it's like, it's really 50-50, me getting to it and them getting to me. And it's a fine balance. And I should not, I found, at least for myself, that I really, I should not try to over control that. This should be inherent to the voice. Otherwise, something's probably missing if I'm forcing it. So then the language comes from that. And then I should say, you know, it's because English is not my mother tongue, it's fun. There's that degree that to begin with, I have the mask of English because it's not me exactly. it's not exactly me. It's a toy language. You know how kids, they play and they invent their own language? The same thing. One of my youngest daughter always tells me, oh, you're so much more fun in English. I'm really scared of you when you speak French. And I think there's something to that. I'm having fun because it's not my language and I have to think to work at it. Every word is a new thing, a little discovery, and it's just fun. And then I have to, and sometimes in my head, it's probably a salad, right, of French and English. I don't know exactly at this point what it is. But then I try to get something across. You know, I have something that I want to say that comes out. And then language trickles. So I have to work at it to get to where it's satisfying. It's satisfying to the voice. I can hear it and it's entertaining and it's fun.
Can you even recall, Cecile? And hi. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I think we spoke on the phone some years ago. I remember. Can you even remember what exercise this story came from?
Yes. I unearthed all my preambles. So this comes from a story that's called Final Dispositions by Linda McAuliffe Moore. That was published in the Sun, I think, in 2012 or something like that, and it was an amazing story about a woman listening in on her siblings making arrangements for her final disposition. So in this case, again, you know, you can see like I was telling earlier. So I borrowed from her voice. But I also borrowed from our material on some level, you know. So it's and I reread actually the story, and it's a really super enjoyable story.
It was probably a pushcart story, I bet. It was one of those.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, this is so revelatory. This thing about that your French identity is a persona in itself. And your American persona. When you're writing, do they vie for attention, or does one take over, or do you use this as an extra layer of a mask?
You mean language between French and English?
Yes.
Yes. I do. A lot of times, I'm having fun thinking of a specific expression in French. And so how would I, that I know is impossible to translate. And I'm thinking, so how do I get that across? And a lot of times the results are very interesting. And a lot of times when you do, like, for example, very literal translation, they always bring something absolutely fun and engaging with them because it's, you know, it's impossible. But it's fun, yes. So I have to say, yes, it does play a big part. I've never tried to write in French. I don't know what that would be like. At that point, I would have to really put on another mask, like pretend I'm not fully French, which I'm probably not fully at that point.
When you described calling Mark the first time, you said, he said in his easygoing American way. So you, in other words, your French identity is not easygoing, or that you see that is, I don't know, stricter or.
I think we're, I think there's something, especially, you know, with maybe literature or intellectuals or whatever you name it, we're a little more uptight and a little more pretentious. Oh, you know, again, I don't know because I haven't really lived in the French literary world, but what I found here is that it's been so uplifting, so encouraging, because at no point in time, somebody who's told me, why are you even doing this? Like so late in your life, you know, why do you start? What do you even try? My dad told me when I first started, he said, what? You gonna do writing? What? Now? Have you ever been published? I said, well, no, I'm just starting. How am I gonna be pre-published even before I start writing? So he was very, you know, like dismissive. And then over time, he became one of my most fervent reader, you know, and really, but it took time. I had to earn respect. I had to earn my space. And here, I think there's a way in which it's more there's more acceptance. You can try something. Just try it, you know, and so to me, that's the American easygoing way.
One of just as a side note, the way Cecile truly tries to picture and embody someone else to be the narrator is very amazing, right? And I'll just one of her stories, right? You use like a pompous newscaster to be the voice of the right, and she really tried to imagine this pompous newscaster being the voice that's speaking as a narrator. And one of them was like a historian, a professor historian, or I don't know, I've lost track for sure, but it's really part of Cecile's technique is to really try and create a picture of someone else that she's using in each of these stories, right? In Gypsy, it is a gypsy, right? It's amazing how far she takes that.
You know, Cecile,
go ahead, Phil.
No, one of the things I'm surprised by is that in this, especially in the Camus version of the journal, is that what's come out, what's evolved out of it is the difficulty of holding that mask that you have to be very conscious of. And what one student described it to me is a heavy mask that as you get near stuff that is difficult to deal with emotionally, the mask becomes heavier because you have to, you know, employ more effort and desire to actually hold it in place. Did you find that in let's say with the bond?
You know, no. I think to me, writing is very performative and it's so freeing in this way. It's fun. I don't have to be me. I can be whoever and perform. And as a matter of fact, I should really start by emptying myself. You know, there was this French actor, Louis Jouvet, who was saying to, you know, you have to really, a good actor has to be completely empty, borderline stupid. Because you have to start there and then you fill yourself with a mask. And that's to me, that's part of the joy of writing. And that's so liberating. So I could speak about horrible things and with joy, just because I'm enacting. It's performative and it's fun. So I think that really allows to tackle dark material and usually, you know, come back with a lot of surprises for yourself in that performing act. So I think it's not, to me at least, if it's successful, the mask becomes second nature and I deeply enjoy it.
Wow. Is there anyone else who would like to ask a question? I mean, this is quite a, I could call on, I'm dying to know what certain people think, but is there anyone else that has a question?
Go, Nancy. Nancy Quinn.
Hi, Cecile.
Hey.
I was going to actually mention the bond because I remember the workshop where that was such difficult material, and your emphasis in your preamble and your response to critique was all about the purity and the beauty of the two individuals, and that any maliciousness was like just vanished. And I just will never forget that because it is such a beautiful story in that way. But will you, in my question is, will you talk a little about your growing preambles? I seem to remember your preambles over time would become like 4 pages long, and it might be useful for others to hear about Cecile's preambles.
Did everyone hear that? I had trouble understanding. Listen, to you look like you were
an
offer someone.
I think I can.
Yeah, you might have to mute yourself, Phil. It was, yeah. Cecile, were you about to answer?
Yeah, and I think I can try to summarize the question, okay. Nancy's question. I think what Nancy was sharing is that when I brought the bond to class and people were asking, you know, this is such difficult material, insist and so on. And my response was, you know, I'm really interested in this being something that's actually pure, something that's actually really heartfelt and profound. Something that's innocent. This was very important to me. So that was the first part of the question. And the other part of the question is, I have a tendency as I go through a story to start with a certain preamble, which, you know, as we all know, I cheat. It's always a postamble. As I go through story, I add from the critique little layers. So what starts with a two-liner or three-liner postamble ends up as a page or two, sometimes even more postamble preamble. Because as I go through the critique, I pick the nuggets that I find really helpful or surprising, and then I go with them, I run with them.
How about we read a little more? Actually, I want to ask more questions about that. How about we read a little more from the bond?
Sure.
Maybe I Saw Mia, page 95.
What page?
Page 95. And Cecile, I'll preface with a question. As I recall the story, it was completely surprising to you and to us as to the direction this story went. I don't remember. It'll be interesting. Let's read and then tell us a little bit about the how this story came to be, because I don't think you had any plan for it when you started it, as I recall.
Yeah, usually I don't have plans for story. The story have plans for me.
Yes.
I saw Mia for the first time in a small provincial clinic. To me, the clinic wasn't small and provincial. To me, the clinic was big, colossal as a pantheon. 4 of me stacked on top of each other would fit through the entrance. My father took me there, holding my toddler hand. It was a rare instance, my father holding my hand. The moment was solemn, filled with nurses murmuring in the hallways like people whispering in churches. There was an elevator, and my father lifted me up to press the button. This was my first elevator. Now that I think of it, I think of all maternities as elevated, hovering above ground. The elevator transported us to a new hallway with a door at the end. I wondered what could be behind the door that my father opened with such care. From across the room, I saw Mia in the arms of my mother and asked my father who she was. My father responded with something that I didn't hear. My father repeated the same thing, and I still couldn't hear. My mother smiled and called me to her. I approached the bed and was encouraged to sit on it. I touched Mia's hand. I was told her name. Mia, I asked. Yes, kiss her, my mother said. And I obeyed my mother. There are certain quakes, ways to be moved that recounted would verge on the sentimental. Certain words and gestures that sound true only once as they spark out of the unexpected morass of feelings. For me, kissing Mia at the clinic was the first shaking, a shaking that left me in a state of questioning, a state that I haven't left yet.
So like I said, I don't recall how this story even got started or where it started. I do recall it being quite a journey.
Yeah. So the reference for the bond was a story by Stefan Zweig that's called A Confusion of Feelings. And it's a novella and in which the main character, the narrator, is a student that revisits an obsession he had with a professor during his youth. And it tackles, and this was written in, I think in 1927, and it tackled homosexuality in a way that probably wasn't very customary at the time. And it's an amazing novella. Zweig is for some reason he's very very read and very well known in continental Europe, and was a little less so here and maybe in the UK as well. And I think they started to reprint his books sometime in the 90s. But I think he is. I've always been fascinated by Zweig, and I always wanted to do Zweig. And so I think this story started out of that, of my my impetus to do Zweig, to be Zweig. So I tried. And again, here the material was sort of dictated by the voice, and it's quite similar in a way, because it's forbidden love. It's forbidden love.
And forbidden to the persona. The persona sees it as, at the time it was society too.
Yeah.
But I mean, mostly to the persona sees it as forbidden.
Yes.
Which makes it so, I mean, to go there and to take on that persona is not easy.
Yeah. But the fun of it, sorry, you muted, Mark. Sorry. The fun of it was to really use that voice first and foremost. This was a voice-driven story. And then I had one thing that I love to do in stories is to explore extreme situations. Because I think we always learn so much from the extremes. And it's obviously, it's also a lot of fun, right? Because it's extreme. So it's not something you come across in your daily. And so you have to really reach for the extreme and try to do it without judgment and try to do it like one paragraph at a time. So what is it like to be in love with your sister? When does that even start? And how does it come about? And, you know, what do you feel? And where does it go? And so it's like one question leads to the next when you explore extreme situations. And I think we learn a lot from them.
So Phil, hi, it's Kathy. How are you? And congratulations. I think that one of the things that's so remarkable to me in all of your work, in this story in particular, is the tenderness that you manage for the character. And you're working in first person. So you've got a first person narrator who's confessing this horrible secret and yet is doing it with still some excitement about it and still some tenderness for himself and the situation. And I'm just wondering, like, what helps you hold that gentleness as you're writing sometimes really difficult stuff?
Thanks, Kathy. Kathy has taken over from Mark for me as my teacher, and like both of them, like, thank you. I think tenderness is like really important. As you hold a mask, you have to do so tenderly. At least, again, for me, because if you come to it with your own judgment, your own agenda, you have to love your characters. You have to love your narrators, no matter how despicable they are. As a matter of fact, the more despicable, the more love you need to give them. Otherwise, it's not going to be interesting. You're going to lose so much. I think in this particular case, there was no question in my mind. This was pure love. Those two were deeply in love. They just happened to be brother and sister. Bad for them. But really, they were just in love. And so I just wanted to, what kind of love is in a way not extreme? I think it's really important to keep that tenderness at the heart of the work.
I think people are hearing some amazing things, and I'm just dying to hear some of the questions people would ask. Nancy, can I call on you? I'm just, because I know what people are working on and dealing with, and how this relates to what you're saying.
You know, thank you, Cecile. You were talking at the beginning, or when Mark was reading your answer to the questions he had posed, you had talked about going slow. And I can imagine that in a story like this, there would be an impulse to go faster, to tell the story and to get it on the page. How do you slow yourself down when you find that you're going too fast from one thing to another? And I guess the other question I would have is, what does it mean to you to go slow?
Go slow is produce two pages in 4 or 5 hours every Friday. That's all I do. That's my output, two pages. I know that if I do three, I have to question myself. Did something happen there? So I've been so formatted by the two pages that this is in general, this is what it means. But then I, to your question is, slow, I think, is accepting the way every scene or every sentence unfolds. And that is very slow in general. Sometimes you have a little bit of an acceleration. Maybe you're going to produce two sentences over 10 minutes. That's relatively fast. It's accepting that it's very slow. And when I don't know about all of you, but when I write, I don't write nonstop. It's very stop and go. It's more stop than go. there's a half sentence that starts forming, and then and then I go back. That's being slow and accepting. And I think what really helps me to not rush is the answer to that for me is to not know. If I don't know what comes, how can I rush to get there? It just have to take its time coming out, you know? And so I think at times I drove Mark crazy because he was asking like, but where is it? Or, you know, what's your, cause I was like very, I was doing preambles that like were very super short and summarized, and I didn't want to reveal a lot of what I was doing. And I think because I really need to let the voice and then my intuition, so to speak, kick in. And I have to not know. That's what allows the slowness that's very necessary, I think, to kick in.
Thank you.
Incredible. Any other questions?
I'd love to. Yeah.
Mark, go on.
Well, let's Cecile, I'd love to take Kathy's point a little further and maybe jump to reading a little bit of Pisces, because I think Pisces is such a, to me, it's humorous, it's dark, and it's tender all at once, right? In so many ways. And all of the stories are, but maybe not as humorous as, the rest of the stories are not quite as humorous as that one is. And I love how, I think there's many things you do to create that narrator that are very interesting. So let's maybe let's read a little bit and then talk about it.
Oh, so where do you, which?
There's two things I like. I mean, I think page 54, I think it is a section I really love. I won't dwell down to 10 to 16, but maybe do we need a little bit of the beginning too?
I can do the I won't dwell.
Yeah, let's do that.
I won't dwell over the minutiae of P's physical transformation. Much of it would find a better home in a medical compendium. How do lungs turn into gills? How does hair become scales? I will say, however, that her transformation had much in common with a poster I had in my bedroom at the time. The artist, a man with an unpronounceable name, had titled it, How Boats Are Born. The first picture showed a flying fish breaking out of an eggshell, and the last one showed a sloop. There were six pictures in all, each showing a different stage of the transmutation. From that childhood series, I've kept a solid and tenacious conviction that there are six stages to every transformation, in which the first four stages can hardly be called changes. The last two phases are the ones during which everything gets played. When a wing becomes a sail and a fish abdomen hardens into a hull. Such was the transformation of P, six stages in all, four of which were fairly moderate and the last two much more dramatic. All of which took 6 years, though not evenly spread throughout that time, during which I went from 10 to 16.
There's so many things about this. So, I mean, I'll go to kind of the pure who is this persona type stuff. It's a first is third, right? Older, younger narrator. You've got all of these things going in. It's a narrator that exiled from their home in Japan, telling this story. It's a coming of age story, ultimately, about the narrator, but it's all told through this transformation of this third person P, right? Mm-hmm. All of these elements going on, all told so seamlessly and so matter-of-factly from this narrator's point of view. How? how did you manage to construct all of that?
Right? So I had a great teacher. And I had a great reference piece. The reference piece was a piece by Primo Levi called Questio de Sensoris that was published or republished in the New Yorker in 2015. And it's a Sensoris that's in a house. And the main character is talking about what it is to live with a Sensoris and what it entails. And it has that very specific professorial voice and also humorous. And it tackles obviously fairly, you know, dark material at the end of the day, I think in this case, but with a very light and professorial tone. So I think I had that. So that was very that was very helpful. I was really guided by Primo. He held my hand like every step of the way. And I think sometimes our references are so strong that they really structure us in ways that are incredible, because it becomes like easy. It becomes easy because you have this mask with that structure that is so strong. And then to adopt it, you know, it's just, you just have to stick yourself in there with that voice and that mask and have fun. So that was one such instance, I think. And then the original idea came from one of my daughters. We were having sushi. And she was telling, and we were having those little bits with the salmon roe. And she was looking at me and says, "Mom, are you not scared that those little eggs are going to sprout in your stomach and transform into fish?" And I don't know, this really blew my mind and I run with it. And she was 10 at the time. And I wanted to also write a piece for her, you know, what it is to become an adolescent, like change from child to adolescent as a girl, what it means. And then Japan. I've never set foot in Japan. I've never been to Japan. I don't know anything about Japan, but I loved exploring it. I loved looking at, you know, what do bathtub look in Japan? They're ofuro. They're like square little boxes. What does that? They have a lid. It's a lot of fun. Between Primo holding my hand and then my daughter like poking my ear and then Japan, it was fun.
Well, this is an education for me because I once or twice considered Primo Levi and got scared and never went near it. So the fact that you could turn it into something this highly entertaining also is amazing. I guess that's a lesson for all of us, isn't it? Get a scary persona and use fun, imaginative material, and it makes it less scary, right? Now, you wouldn't want to use Primo Levi for the crematorium story.
Cecile, if you're doing your 2 pages every Friday, mm-hmm. those are the 2-page assignments that you write with your preamble? Is that what you're saying? Those are the exercises that you write.
Yeah. So
on Friday.
Yeah, all the stories were writer studio exercises that were written 2 pages at a time every Friday.
And then when do you do the finishing of allowing them to bloom into stories?
Cecile,
I think Cecile's bringing in 2 pages every week for the same story, repeatedly. So expanding and extending her piece. So it's not a new story every week. It's continuing the work. I'll say enhancing and improving her preamble as she goes too. So in many ways, right, enhancing her focus as she goes. Mm-hmm. And then I do think you come back and you ultimately, once the piece is complete, you do a full revisit.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think maybe that's worth talking about, Cecile. I don't think we've hit this enough. You ultimately really create a set of rules for yourself, right, as your preamble. And you don't necessarily have them in mind, or they're not quite unlocked. And that's where the difference between you start out with the exercise preamble and the exercise, but over time, as you work on it further, it really becomes your own.
Yes.
Right? Do you want to add to that or talk about that, how you figure out what the rules are that you want your preamble to be?
Yeah, I mean, I think what happens is, so I start with a voice and a general territory. I don't know where I'm going because it's very important to not know. But I know the territory and I have an idea of the voice. I'm usually excited about a voice first and foremost. But then sometimes, you know, as it happens with stories, you start and then it points you in a certain direction. You have to let the voice guide you. So it creates its own rules as you write, because you're going to start with something, but as you develop it, the sentences will slowly accrue and point in certain directions. And that's where, as I come to class, there's the critique. People are hearing, different things that come from the voice. Then this has this effect. Interesting. And then should I push it further, or should I dial this down because this I don't like, or it gets boring or laborious. And so as I go, then I will refine the rules, because the voice picks up or accelerates, and then I discover new rules out of the voice that I, you know, didn't necessarily expect, which is fun. Yeah, sometimes I brought to class the beginnings of novels. I never finished the novels. I have two in a drawers, and so I've inflicted on the class like maybe like 52 weeks of the same stuff, 2 new pages at a time. So
Mark, I'm dying to know what some people hear, which, you know, at the end of the class, which of these stories they would turn into exercise is.
Let's start going there. I think Sylvie raised your hand as a question.
Oh.
Yes, it's not in response to Phil. First, I mean, it's so inspiring to hear you, and I wish all my students were here in the memoir class, because you just really give a wonderful example of it's like a testimony, right, to the workshop, the method, how it's working. And it's I wish, you know, everybody would listen to it. And congratulations. I was curious about the narrator thing, the voice. When you say you would bring 2 pages per week, and do a continuation, right? Did you ever change narrator Did you ever think, wow, that's not working, I need to get a new person narrator here?
Yeah, I did. As a matter of fact, that happened to me very recently. I was very excited to tackle a new story with a voice that I was very excited with, and a French author, actually. And it didn't work. And I'm very stubborn. So I try it and I think, well, if I get really excited, there must be something to it. And I try it again. And I think in this case, I brought it like 3 or 4 times. And then I'm like, this doesn't work. This just doesn't pick up. This doesn't, it doesn't feel energized. It doesn't have a velocity. It doesn't engage people. It doesn't surprise me as much as I would want to. I'm dodging something here. It doesn't work. And then I have to dump it, like the work of like 4 or 5 Friday afternoons, and like, no, no good, start over. And then I recently picked up like a new reference for the same material I was trying to write, which I feel is probably the most difficult thing I've been doing, is write about my children, one of my daughter. It's easy to go after your parents, much less so to go after your children. Because you, I think, Kathy, you said, and very rightly so, you want them to be able to write their own story. So to give yourself permission to write their story, even if it's completely imaginative, is super hard. And I'm actually struggling with that a lot right now, but I'm stubborn. So I wanna see whether I can do it. But it's very scary. It's actually one of the most the scariest experience I've had so far. Because yeah, again, going after parents is okay. Going after children, not so much okay.
And what persona are you using for that?
I'm actually using, I forgot the name. Kathy, will you help me with the name of the author? It's one that was referred to in a craft class lately, the Mengistu class. She spoke about Doctoro?
Yeah, Doctoro.
Doctoro, the Book of Daniel. And so what struck me in the craft class is Mengistu, she was saying, it's a really interesting narrator because it's meanders between first and third person, and the first person is telling their own story in the third. And so I thought, oh, that's interesting. And I bought the book and I started reading the first few pages and I said, well, I'm getting excited with that. Let's see what happens with my material. So I don't know, you know, where this is going to go, but it felt that it had more wind and more velocity than the other. So I had to switch. Yes. So I've had to do that.
It was fascinating. Ed Doctorow. Wow.
Hey, Phil, one before we turn to asking people if they
want. We don't have to do that. This is,
well,
so
I think there's whatever. I'm going to call out one person in particular, John Greenberg. Get ready. But I'm going to ask Cecile a question first. One more question, Cecile, and then we didn't really talk about any of your third person pieces, and you just referenced it, like MRI or Polish Dusk. How do you think about the persona? Do you think about the persona differently as you work on your third person pieces and how you construct them, or because they are also, you know, very strong narrators?
So to me, a third person narrator, it's exactly the same process. It has to have a voice in the very same way as a first person. And I have to imagine my third person narrator as much, if not even more, than my first. Whether it's a subdued third person who's like barely present on the page, or a very opinionated third person constantly interrupting the conversation with their comments. It has to have that voice quality. So whether it's a third person, second person, or first person plural, like all of them, it's the same process. They have to be alive, and so they have to be embodied. And a third person narrator certainly has to be as embodied, I think, as a first person.
Yeah. No, that's great. So I think that passes. That's a great chance to turn to John, because I think he's going to answer this way. John, if you're there still, let me verify you're there still, but what would you turn, how would you, out of all of the work in Cecile's exercise book, is there one you'd think of as an exercise? How would you deal with it? And yeah, I'm want to talk to, you know, and if there's anything you want to comment about from our history in working with Cecile, add that as well.
I am still here. I think I'm so attracted to Pisces. And I think it's for a lot of the reasons that we've commented on in class. Because I think your ability to hold mystery is something that is really constant and present in your stories. And in that story in particular, you do it with never providing an answer. And I think that's for that narrator, there's like a certain amount of obsession or sort of like intense focus on the idea of the transformation. And it's really the ability to follow that intense focus and to take pleasure in it. I don't know. I mean, I think for as an exercise or as a narratorial exercise, that would be my answer, is sort of to like follow the voice's interest. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if that's really an answer to your question or not, but that would be my, my direction.
That's good. I actually will turn the question to any of the San Francisco people first and say, what would you do from what we've seen from this book? Go, Nancy.
I think I would actually look at the bond and go where what Cecile talks about in extremities. Just aim yourself at something extreme and then inject as much tenderness as you can for the people in those extreme circumstances. I really love that idea.
Lucinda, I'm just dying to know which of these stories would you take on or personas?
I think Pisces as well.
Wow.
Yeah, I liked that narrator very much. Yeah. And I haven't been doing much first person, so this could be a really nice way to mix things up and to play in a way that I haven't. Just having these conversations has already sparked so many ideas related to stories that I'm working on. So, So thank you, Cecile. Thank you so much.
Well, also having, you know, from a child's point of view, that kind of infatuation and identity crisis. It's with a fish. Marie, how about you?
I don't want to jump on the bandwagon, but I really like the bond. I love the extreme piece and just trying to stimulate the thing between your ears with something just totally outlandish and fun and performative like that. It seems like just totally delicious fun to do that. So that seemed like a great challenge.
Anyone else want to go?
I loved Pisces so much, and I am so eager to, you know, use that persona. And also, I used to think that I had a prejudice against things that were sort of, fantastical. And then I realized, no, I don't. I just don't like the not good ones when they're really good like this. I love them. And then I remembered I had also loved Mrs. Caliban. So, you know, I have something in mind and I love this story. So thank you.
That's such a big point, actually, because when there's this much skill and imagination, it's not fantastical. It makes it terrifyingly credible.
Yeah, can I say something about this? Because that's what I thought too, for an exercise, I mean, for the memoir class, you know, to apply this in Pisces, this commitment that the narrator has to the imaginary premise, right? It's like, it's totally valid. It's totally, it's solid. There's clear rules to it. And the narrator totally commits to that. And it's almost like a distraction to what the story really is. And I felt that could be a wonderful exercise to force the memoir student to go beyond the facts of their truth and, you know, experience, and to kind of create something totally imaginary and to commit to it fully. And through that commitment to see what could be revealed that they may not be able to go at in a more direct way. So I thought that would be a good exercise.
Is there anyone else that would like, that would reveal, divulge a particular? Okay, I see a hand raising. I never saw that symbol before. Okay.
That's me. Thank you. Cecile, I love this work so much. And I'm so inspired that you use this, the writer studio technique to create this fantastic body of work. I would very much love to work with the Gypsy Book of Revelations narrator. The thing that unlocked it for me, that got me really excited, is that line where she says that her children would be surprised to know that she could write, that they thought she was illiterate, that they wouldn't even know she could use the word illiterate. And the idea that this is a first-person narrator who's like a secret to everyone, that nobody really knows her. Maybe this persona was released upon her death. And like, what really are the stakes? Like, she's dead, you know? But I would start with the same scenario, my own funeral, but maybe depart from there. But like, of writing as a sort of someone who nobody ever knew in their own lifetime, from that persona. Thank you.
Okay, Mark, you want to?
Great. Right. I think, well, Cecile, really, thank you.
It's just, you're so okay.
Hey guys.
You're so generous. You know, I think I'm going to ask you to teach a craft class for us. The Stephen Zweig wouldn't be a bad idea. I should have asked you in private, not in front of everyone.
No, thank you. Thank you. I really, you know, I want to say it again. I wouldn't be there without the class. It's what I do. I'm the result of the class. You know, I really am. That's how I work, and that's how I will continue to work. I don't know how to do it otherwise. So it's just, it's great. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's just so great. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, good night and bye-bye. Thank you.